Thanks for listening to this Hopi Music Repatriation Project podcast. My name is Trevor Reed, and I'm the lead researcher for the project. For this first podcast, I'd like to start where the project began, here in New York, at Columbia University's Center for Ethnomusicology. Aaron Fox, now chair of the Department of Music at Columbia, has spent the last several years working to repatriate indigenous voices from the Laura Bolton World Music Collection, which is housed here at the center. His work in community-partnered repatriation provided the framework for our efforts to return Laura Bolton's Hopi recordings back to the communities from which they originate. Aaron Fox is here with me today. Aaron, welcome. And I wanted to start by asking you about the origins of the project. Giving historic recordings back to Native communities as opposed to keeping them for study and preservation seems a little bit counter to the traditional purpose of a major research university like Columbia. I was wondering if you could tell us about the idea of community-partnered repatriation, how it first came about, and what led you to pursue this course in repatriating Laura Bolton's recordings.
There's a really good story about that. This was back in 2003, 2004. I had just been put in charge of the archive of Laura Bolton's recordings, which had been here for about 30 years before that, but the director retired, and I was left holding this task of figuring out what was in these archives and how to manage them. And as it happened, I was reading my retired director's correspondence and came across a series of emails that had been printed out, which detailed an encounter between the director and a family of Navajo folks from Albuquerque, New Mexico. And the person who'd made this connection was a young woman named Nanaba Becker. Nanaba was a student in Columbia's Masters of Fine Arts program in film. That's what's interesting about this is that that program is in our building. And not only is it in our building, but the studio at the time, they've moved it since, but the studio where Nanaba worked was literally four floors below the shelves where our archival recordings are held. So that will make this story more uncanny. As it turned out, Nanaba and her family had become aware that Columbia possessed recordings of her family's ancestors. She is the great-granddaughter of a very well-known Navajo medicine man from the late 19th and early 20th century, whose name was Pablo Huelito. Her parents, Vicky and Herb Becker, who live in Albuquerque, Vicky is the granddaughter of Pablo Huelito and the daughter of one of Pablo's sons, Frank Huelito, who also appears on these recordings. Now, the story gets a little complicated. Vicky Becker's mother passed away. The Beckers are Catholic. And in addition to having traditional remembrance, they had a Catholic wake and invited the whole family to come down to Albuquerque for the grandmother's funeral and wake. And Nanaba had to come from New York, and Nanaba's sister, Bitta, had to come from Chicago, where she was in law school. This is a family of accomplished kids. And as I heard the story, Biddy picked up a copy of Smithsonian Folkways Navajo Songs on her way out to see her family for this wake, thinking it would be nice to have some Navajo traditional music to play in the background. So the story, as I have further heard it, is that the family is sitting around mourning their grandmother and remembering her. And this record is playing in the background when Vicky Becker, this is the granddaughter of Pablo Huelito and the daughter of Frank, perks right up and says, "I know that voice." And the family gets the CD out and they open the liner notes. And sure enough, there in the liner notes are the names Pablo and Frank Huerito, H-U-E-R-I-T-O. So the family read the notes, and reading the notes, they discovered that there was an archive attached to these recordings and that it was at Columbia University, where Nanaba happened to be a student already. They learned about Laura Bolton from the notes. And Vicky once said, so we Googled Laura Bolton and learned about the archive such as it was. There was very, very little documentation of this archive available online at the time. So they sent Nanaba upstairs, and she came up one day. This is the year before I took over, and she knocked on the door of my predecessor's office and came in and said, my great-grandfather's on your shelves here, what are we going to do about that? Could we listen to it? Could my family have access to this material? My predecessor said, sure, you know, next time your family comes through New York, why don't you have them stop by, and we'll have the center's assistant, you know, sit down and queue up the tapes, and you can listen to them. And this happened a few weeks later, or months later. Nanaba's parents, Vicky and Herb, came to New York, and they and Nanaba sat down with one of our then graduate students, Toby King, and listened to a few songs, and were deeply moved, as I understand it. At which point, they had to go, and I think my predecessor promised in a follow-up email that he would have copies sent to them, but right about then was when he decided to retire, as these things do happen. The flow got broken, and 6 or 8 months went by when nothing happened, and nothing got sent. So I found this email, and I walked downstairs to the film labs, and I said, which one's Nanaba? We had a coffee and talked, and I said, you know, I want to make good on the original promise and make copies of these for your family, but I have this crazy idea that we could do more than that. Really, the crazy idea came from talking to Nanaba and thinking about her life story, because she's a filmmaker, a very good one, an award-winning one at that, and was thinking about her own interest in hearing her great-grandfather's songs as an artistic text from which she herself could draw inspiration or even use in her films, as she has actually gone on to do. It was in that moment also that I had just taken over the center that we were broke and had almost no resources. And I was trying to think of a project that would be fundable, to be honest, that would be innovative in some way, that would launch the center with a fresh identity of doing something nobody else was doing. And so here was this sort of perfect fusion of realizing that we had this enormous collection of indigenous music, or if not enormous, certainly big and of high quality, of ambiguous status in many cases. It's ownership unclarified, although Columbia possessed clearly the legal title to what are called the mechanical rights, that is, the rights to authorize the publication of these recordings. So, you know, talking to Nanaba, then meeting her family as they next came to New York, and then visiting them in Albuquerque when I next went to New Mexico for a conference. And pretty soon we started hacking out a proposal, which I managed through endless annoyance of my superiors and in the administration, eventually to get some funding from the university to begin to develop what's become the central idea of our archive now, some 7 years later, which is to repatriate all of it, but to repatriate all of it on a different model than we've seen other people do, and on a model that's more effective at achieving a couple of final goals, or maybe they're not final, and that's the point, a couple of long-term goals. One, the fair treatment of the communities from which these materials were obtained and recorded, that means doing the right thing by the right people in terms of rights, means clarifying who has the right to authorize the use of the materials and so forth. But beyond that, it seemed to me that there was a goal that was eluding archives and was sort of not in the discussion enough even then, that occurred to me from working with Nanaba and her family, which was that these kinds of resources could be useful in ways that weren't being imagined with a focus on rights and ownership, and that their real value wasn't the possibility of a few dollars in royalties potentially coming from a Smithsonian Folkways recording, although those rights have to be handled appropriately. Their real value was so much greater than that. And it was the very value of cultural survival and of the survival of languages and musics and cultural practices that are of great concern to many of the communities in which these materials were recorded. They were recorded in many cases as documents of what Laura Bolton and people like her believed were dying cultures. And so it's a great irony, perhaps, but also a great relief that that didn't come to pass at all. Now we can go back and sort of make that right, not by treating it as a legal transaction, but by treating it as a chance to repair the relationship that was born in that moment.
It's a fascinating story, and it sounds like such an ambitious project as well. You mentioned Laura Bolton, and I'd like to share a little bit more about that story through this podcast.
Sure.
you know, the Laura Bolton Collection makes up a significant part of the Center for Ethnomusicology's holdings, and I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about Bolton, what she collected and how she collected it, and how these recordings ended up at Columbia.
Okay, well, there's a long version of that story that she tells very romantically in her own autobiography called The Music Hunter, which was published in 1968, shortly after her arrival at Columbia. She's one of these people for whom there's a sort of public version of her life, which was a performance of herself. She made her living performing the role of Laura Bolton, Music Hunter, is the title of her autobiography, sort of larger than life. Then there's the reality of a woman born to fairly modest circumstances in Ohio, Comagat, Ohio, I believe it was, in 1899, raised in a fairly strict family with a lot of classical music, but also a lot of interesting popular and indigenous musics around her in the Midwest at that time, the late 19th century. And a burning ambition to have a voice in public life, specifically concerning music, that began to develop in her, and an interest in traditional cultures that began to develop in her in the 20s. She married a sort of swashbuckling rich guy who liked to go on safaris. And in the late 20s, she went on a safari with him to Africa, during which, while the men hunted, she encountered traditional African music and fancied herself completely moved, perhaps was completely moved by this, and also fancied herself having an experience that she could communicate as a kind of identity for herself of being an explorer. She wanted in, even then, I think, to the academic universe of what was then becoming ethnomusicology. It was still thought of then as comparative musicology or musical or as anthropology. But it was very difficult for women to go into the academic route. There were a lot of interesting women involved in the birth of ethnomusicology who had very marginal careers in the field because it was just a male-dominated enterprise then. And especially with respect to Native music, there are a number of major collectors and scholars who kind of crossed the boundary between what we might now call public intellectuals, people who make a living lecturing or appearing in the media and giving their opinion on things and performing their celebrity selves, and scholars who work, you know, toiling in obscurity in archives, publishing books, and nonetheless get paid for doing it. Laura Bolton never got paid by anybody else for doing her work, so she was also an entrepreneur with a number of interesting techniques for funding her work, the most important of which was the ability to interest rich men, I have to put it that way, which is not a talent that should be underrated, perhaps. Because it funded for her a long career of excursions abroad to many places, Africa, South America, East Asia, throughout Native North America, Canada, and elsewhere in Europe, especially Eastern and Central Europe, the Middle East, Egypt. She also, of course, did develop her own career and supported herself as a public intellectual. She took gigs teaching and lecturing at universities. She gave public lectures. She toured, as was the custom then. She would go on sort of speaking tours and give presentations and play recordings from her field work and show slides and answer people's burning questions, born of real curiosity often about African or Native American culture and music. You know, then the subject of a kind of very romantic and in some cases very racist view in mainstream society. So actually, if you look at her in context, she was a progressive person. She had what at the time would have been a progressive politics of convincing people that Native and Indigenous and tribal peoples were not their racial inferiors, but were producers of beautiful cultural forms that were indicative of our common humanity. For the early 20th century, a view of difference that was relatively progressive. It was romantic, however. And if you read her book, you can see there is a tone sometimes of what we might call patronizing her Native consultants, especially, or of marveling at their, innocence or simplicity, for example. There's respect, but there's with that comes a kind of diminution of agency, you might say. And that carries over to her interactions. She had many different kinds of interactions with her consultants and the people she recorded. And she recorded all different kinds of people all over the world. Sometimes a very imperious one. She often had, the support of powerful local leaders or military in the case of the Arctic military escort, you know, kind of an intimidating presence when someone shows up with a tape recorder and a general in full brass by her side saying, can we record your songs? But she also sometimes clearly provided remuneration to consultants, although not all the time. Generally not, actually. We can document that she occasionally made promises to assist in projects of local cultural reclamation, which don't really seem to have been followed through on, mostly to return copies of recordings or to return herself to communities to do further work. But along the way, she built up this increasing archive, and she was part of a community of other people doing this kind of thing. This was a very common activity in the mid-20th century in the United States, people like Alan Lomax, for example. She came, I should tell the story of how she came to Columbia. After spending the 30s and 40s and 50s traveling widely, releasing a number of record albums, a total of 11 albums, I believe it was, on Folkways, when it was a private, not government-owned entity back in the 50s, and lecturing and touring and so forth, she came to New York in the early 60s and became involved with a recently widowed elderly man named Clarence Levy. Clarence was an architect, and he was at the time in his late 80s. His wife, Alice, had died recently. He was very wealthy. He was a multimillionaire at the time, Columbia's oldest living alumnus. And Columbia at the time was actually very broke. The university was having a lot of financial troubles in the 60s and 70s. And so they had their eye on Clarence Levy's money as their oldest living alumnus. And Laura Bolton took up a romantic relationship with Clarence Levy. Clarence Levy, in order to woo and impress his new 30 years younger girlfriend, Laura Bolton, made a donation to Columbia to buy Laura Bolton's recordings for the university, which secured for Laura finally a regular income because there was an annuity on the purchase of about $10,000 a year for the rest of her life, which in the 60s was some real money, and an office. For Laura, this was a sense of arrival. This was finally being accepted into the academic world, you know, with a title and an office. She wasn't salaried, but she had an income from her work. And Columbia had its eye on the much bigger amount of money Clarence has still had in the bank. So it went along with this, even though it turns out Laura Bolton could be quite a difficult person to work with. And as a result, her collection and her office shifted between the libraries, the School of International and Public Affairs, and eventually only a third location wound up in the music department in the late 60s. The music department tolerated Laura Bolton and participated in Columbia's wooing of Clarence Levy. This story, by the way, has never been told in public before, except informally. And true to form, in 1972, when Clarence Levy passed away at the age of 94, he left Columbia roughly $5 million. So this was considered quite the coup. The music department asked for a cut of that, as it was clearly Levy's intention to endow the ethnomusicology center that Laura Bolton had been working to build in those years. The university said, we're too broke to do that. So they gave the ethnomusicology center a small annual budget. They agreed to hire a senior ethnomusicologist, and they hired a man named Dieter Christensen, who is, in fact, the predecessor director I mentioned in my earlier response, who was there for the next 30 years. Dieter Christensen, who was a German trained at the Berlin Phonogram Archive and a very sort of formal academic archivist, did not get along with Laura Bolton. And Laura Bolton quickly soured on Columbia once she realized that Columbia no longer wanted her, which is in fact the case. It immediately dispossessed her of her office once Clarence Levy left his money. So in a huff, Laura Bolton began to alienate parts of her collection and say, this is not part of what was purchased by my late boyfriend's bequest. Her instruments, some of her recordings, and many of her print and photographic materials. She also began to make it harder and harder for Christensen to catalog and appraise the collection. And she left and moved to Arizona to retire in 1973 after only a year of Christensen's presence driving her out of here. And it actually took until her death in 1980 for the terms of what exactly belongs to Columbia to be settled in writing in terms of an agreement. And here's what happened. It's very messy. When Christensen arrived, Columbia agreed to ship Bolton's archive to the Library of Congress for safekeeping, an exchange for which the Library of Congress would make three copies of this on tape, two of which went to Columbia and one of which went to Laura Bolton herself. And in addition, I think another copy was made, which is the actual reference collection at the Library of Congress. Bolton moved off to Arizona with her instruments and her copies of the tapes. Columbia kept its two sets of the tapes. And little was heard from Bolton in the ensuing 10 years. She lived a quiet another decade or so until she passed away. You know, Bolton lived a really rich life. She met with Gandhi, I believe. She met with Haile Selassie. She met with presidents and prime ministers and leaders. And she could have cultivated friends in high places. She traveled very wildly. She had certainly an adventurous romantic life. And she did amass a collection that, while uneven, contained some irreplaceable gems of documented traditional music practices that, you know, we've come to believe through practice and prospective thinking represent really singular resources for the future. So in many ways, you can argue she had a very successful career, sustained herself doing what she loved, and produced a legacy that we're now trying to activate. And she's a fascinating figure. She's a very 20th century figure.
What a charismatic character, and what an amazing heritage she's left behind through all her travels and her work. Now fast forward 70 years after the original recordings that she made of several different Native peoples, I want to find out a little bit about the work that you've done in and around Barrow, Alaska, with the Inupiaq community. And I understand that you've been working to return recordings and also on some other projects, and I'm hoping that you'd be able to share some of the results of your work there.
Sure. Well, I told the story of Naiva Becker and the Navajo recordings, which is an ongoing story and one that needs some more attention. But that was the first project that occurred to me when I got this big idea talking with Naiva. Shortly thereafter, I started looking through the archive for other kinds of projects. And I focused a lot on the 1930s because it occurred to me that anybody who would remember ending of that era would be in their 70s and 80s at this point, if they were still alive. So I thought, let's start with the oldest stuff, and that is the oldest stuff in the Bolton archive. There were some other materials that aren't Bolton at Columbia, too, from the 30s that have interested me a great deal, including some Appalachian recordings. So I developed a project to work with those Appalachian recordings and with the Navajo project with the Beckers. And then about a year into doing that, and I got this funding from the university, I got an email from a young PhD student at the University of Oklahoma, then preparing to go do research for her doctoral dissertation in cultural geography in a place called Barrow, Alaska. Her name was Chia Sakakibara. And I get inquiries like this all the time when you're a senior, when you're running an archive or whatever. You get people write you and say, I hear your archive has X kind of material. I'm wondering if I could work with it. So here comes this standard email from Dr. Sakakibara, then graduate student Sakakibara, saying, I heard, you know, third hand that there are some 1940s recordings made in Barrow, Alaska in your archive. She may have looked it up because at this point we had published a catalog, sort of rough and ready catalog of the recordings. And she said, I'm, you know, a serious researcher. I'm about to go to Barrow and do a year of field work on traditional subsistence hunting and whaling and its relationship to expressive culture and to climate change, which at the time I couldn't figure out how those went together. But she said, I'm interested in these sort of historical dimensions of expressive culture in relation to changes in subsistence hunting. And so could I listen to these 1946 recordings? And I wrote her back and I said, you know, you're a qualified researcher and I will agree to send you a set of these recordings on CD if you agree to these terms where you can't file share them and you can't give them away and you can't publish them without permission, et cetera, which is what we typically do in such circumstances with. That's the historical practice of archives like ours, is to determine the research is credentialed, impose constraints, and allow people access. I said, but did you say you were going to Barrow? And she wrote me back and said, yes, I'm going to Barrow for, you know, a year. I got an NSF grant to do this research. And I said, okay. I just looked at the notes for these recordings, which I had never looked at before. And it was about 115 items, mostly songs, a few stories and dog calls and things like this, performed by Inupiat Eskimo people in 1946 in this little town on the very northern tip of Alaska. And in the notes were seven names, seven adult men who performed, were actually, their names were spelled out and written out. And this is a real blessing to find this in an archive, if you're interested in repatriation. So I wrote a letter that said, "Dear Barrow person, if you know these men's names, if you're related to these men, would you get in touch with me? I've got some materials I'd like to talk to you about." And I asked Chia to take it with her for her year in the Arctic and just to give it to anybody she met that seemed interested in this kind of thing or had a name that resembled one of these names. And she did this. And it turns out that's a really silly thing to distinguish in the world of Arctic people, since there are about 9,000 Inupiaq Eskimos. And virtually any one of them can calculate very quickly how he or she is related to almost any other one of them through kinship, through family, and as well to any common ancestor, certainly. So almost everybody was related to one of these seven men. And my invitation to get in touch, where I said, you know, we have these songs, generated a kind of firestorm of response. I got a lot of email, especially a few phone calls and a couple letters saying, we want to hear this music. We're interested in hearing our grandfathers or our great uncles or, you know, my appa's brother's cousin perform and sing. And so I checked with a few specialists in Inupiaq culture and said, is there anything here that would be considered sensitive or sacred or that couldn't go out this way? And Larry Kaplan at the University of Alaska was very helpful. Tony Woodbury, one of my teachers at Texas, who's a Yupik specialist, but similar cultural system, agreed with me that this was feasible. And we just, what I'd like to say is open source the project, and we started sending CDs to everybody who asked, who wrote us from Alaska or otherwise convinced us that they were Inupiaq. We sent out something like 75 to 100 sets of CDs over the course of about a year. And then Chia came back, Chia Sakakibara came back to Oklahoma and was working on writing her dissertation, and I was working on other things. And a few months past all this, we heard, well, these two grandsons of the main singer on the recordings, a man named Joseph Sikwainuk. He had two grandsons named Vernon Elofgok and Riley Sikwainuk. And Vernon and his wife, Isabel, and Riley had put this group together, a dance group, which there were already three in Barrow, but it's a big deal to put one together. It's a lot of work. And they were transcribing and learning and recreating the dances to their grandfather's songs. I thought this was really fascinating, and so I started to pay attention a little more. I started to listen to these recordings myself really seriously and read the part of Bolton's book where she talks about collecting them. And then a few months later, we heard, oh, they just won something called the World Eskimo and Indian Olympics, WIO, which is a sort of big pan-tribal Alaska Native Games Olympic event at which drumming and dancing are part of the competition. And winning it is a huge honor and a really big deal. It's an annual competition, and there are a lot of different villages send groups to dance. And the kids from Barrow who had formed that year, roughly as a kind of kid-driven project too, not with much elder supervision, had brought their performance of these repatriated songs up to a level where they could win the most prestigious competition in the state at what they do. So at that point, I called Chia in Oklahoma, and I said, Chia, you have to take me to Alaska. I have to see what's happening, because in our proposals for this work, we predict something like this might happen 10 years down the line with a lot of work. But instead, all we did was send up copies of CDs to descendants, and all of a sudden, you know, this recordings are not just back, they're alive again. They're you know, being performed. New dances are being written for them. People are, you know, joining this group. And so I brought Chia to New York, and we planned out a visit for Thanksgiving of 2007. And we went up there for 8 days in November of 2007. And I met the kids who were doing this. I met the tribe's senior musical elder, who everybody said, go speak to this man. His name is Warren Matumyuk. Go speak to him first, and if you want to continue working up here on music, he's really the person whose blessing and validation will confer any kind of legitimacy. And also, he's the guy who can tell you about these songs. So we went to see Warren one day, telling him that we would, you know, like an hour of his time. 3 days later and 15 hours of interviews later, after having listened at Warren's insistence to every track on the recordings, we had Warren's sort of official stamp of approval to proceed. And by then I had fallen in love with the town and the community and Warren, and the idea of building on what had happened so organically already. It struck me that here was a case where there was a clear line to be followed, that if successful would prove the concept of what we've come to talk about as community partnered or collaborative repatriation, and that I could see, you know how when you're you know, an artist and you're painting or you're carving something, you start to see the form come out after a while. First you're just looking at a block of wood, and then you start whittling, and then at some point you start to see the shape of a bear or a dolphin or whatever it is you're imagining come out of the wood or the stone. And it was that moment, actually, it was those 3 days with Warren when I saw the project that eventually became so very successful over the last couple of years in Barrow come out of the stone at me. It fills me with optimism to know that we've proved the concept that you can go back in time through oral history and through ethnography and through collaboration and recollect a lot of knowledge and information about the recordings that Laura Bolton didn't know to collect or didn't have the sensibility to collect. It's rather amazing to watch 80-year-old elders who have to, you know, walk with a cane or a walker have a song come on and become so animated that they stand up and start dancing to say, this is the way this would have been danced in Point Hope or Wainwright. And the dance everybody does now was given away from the Wainwright dancers, you know, in the 70s sometime by so-and-so, so that other people could do it. So we can actually track the local intellectual histories and ownership histories of these materials, for example. And that opens the door to a much richer documenting of the community's history throughout that same period. And the idea is that this isn't a one-time deal. We're not returning stuff in a box and saying, here you are, it's all yours. We're trying to say this is not a transaction, it's a relationship. You know, the more we keep working on it, the more uses and the more value this collection will end up having, both for communities and for us, for scholars, for those of us who work in archives and work on academic ethnomusicology and such things as that.
Great. Thank you, Aaron, for being with us on this podcast today. For more information about the Center for Ethnomusicology and Aaron's work, you can visit ethnocenter.org. And also visit the Hopi Music Repatriation Project website at hopimusic.wordpress.com. Thank you.
Thank you.